This is January 24th, 2016, and I'm going to read an article, comment on an article about secular Buddhism. And this is written by its main, what I think we could all call the main proponent of secular Buddhism, which is Stephen Batchelor. Just some background on him, in his own words here. Well, no, I'll just sort of paraphrase. He says he was neither born a Buddhist nor raised in a Buddhist culture. No, he's a Brit. I grew up in a broadly humanist environment, did not attend church, and was exempted from scripture classes, as they were then called, at grammar school in Watford. When he was 18, he left England and traveled to India, where he settled in the Tibetan community around the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala. It's a very northern edge of India, in the foothills of the Himalayas. He became a Buddhist monk at the age of 21, and then for 10 years underwent a formal monastic education in Buddhist doctrine, philosophy, and meditation. And then he's quite a prolific author, a magnificent writer. In another article here, I'm reading that his break with Buddhist orthodoxy led to his first book, The Faith to Doubt, which was published in 1990. I did a Taisho or two on that years ago. In a series of volumes that strike a welcome balance between personal memoir, philosophical and historical inquiry, and practical instruction, including two bestsellers, Buddhism Without Beliefs and Living with the Devil, Batchelor has written his way to a radical rethinking of Buddhism itself. And then his newest book is called After Buddhism, Rethinking the Dharma for a Secular Age. And he considers that to be his kind of magnum opus. The article I'm going to be reading from here is appeared in Tricycle magazine in the fall of 2012. Just a week ago, as I was driving to the center on a Sunday morning, I heard him interviewed by Krista, whatever, who has this program.
Tippett.
Krista Tippett, who has this Sunday morning 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock program called On Being. And he heard him in his own voice talk about this passion of his, secular Buddhism. But let's go to the article. There's a one of the reasons I'm reading from this is because I think he has a lot to offer. There's a lot to his point of view, and I find myself quite open to it, but with some concerns. So it starts, "I am a secular Buddhist. It has taken me years to fully come out, and I still feel a nagging tug of insecurity, a faint aura of betrayal in declaring myself in these terms. My practice as a secular Buddhist is concerned with responding as sincerely and urgently as possible to the suffering of life in our saeculum." That's the origin of the word secular. And he defines it for us. The saeculum meaning this world, this age in which we find ourselves now, and future generations will find themselves later. I see the aim of Buddhist practice to be not the attainment of a final nirvana, but rather the moment-to-moment flourishing of human life within the ethical framework of the Eightfold Path here on Earth. The Eightfold Path is the fourth of the Four Noble Truths. Eightfold Path is sort of a roadmap, a prescription for how to attain liberation and stop causing suffering. Very, very quickly, it's right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And as I always say at introductory workshops in Zen, in the Zen school of Buddhism, those eight ways are all encapsulated in the pure awareness that we call Zen practice of being fully present. He goes on, given what is known about the biological evolution of human beings, the emergence of self-awareness and language, the sublime complexity of the brain, and the embeddedness of such creatures in the fragile biosphere that envelops this planet, I cannot understand how, after physical death, there can be continuity of any personal consciousness or self, propelled by the unrelenting force of acts, karma, committed in this or previous lives. So there he nails two things that he has obviously had trouble with for a long time, the doctrine of rebirth, and the doctrine of karma, two very, very central aspects of Buddhist doctrine. And then he says, for many, perhaps most of my co-religionists, this admission might lead them to ask, why then, if you don't believe such things, do you still call yourself a Buddhist? I guess I'll just plunge into these two things before going further. So, rebirth. As I hope everyone is aware, in Zen, there's no reason for you to believe in rebirth. I gather from what I've read here and there over the years that in Tibetan Buddhism, generally speaking, I don't know how broad this is, but generally speaking, in Tibetan Buddhism, you're expected to believe in rebirth. In fact, when I first ran across Stephen Batchelor's passion for secular Buddhism, it was in these pages of the same magazine, Tricycle, quite a few years ago, where they presented a debate between Stephen Batchelor and Robert Thurman about rebirth. I think they use the word reincarnation, which is not exactly the same. All right, just to finish that, a reincarnation, as I understand it, posits a soul that, an unchanging soul that moves from one lifetime to the next, whereas rebirth, which is more of a Buddhist idea, rebirth will accept no such thing as anything permanent, any permanent entity called a soul or anything else, but rather rebirth is just really the continuation of a process of change and development. So he's always clearly been, always, I don't know, but for many years, argued that you don't need to believe in rebirth to be a serious practitioner of the Dharma, and I agree completely with him. I would suppose that any Zen teacher would feel the same, but Robert Thurman, who is for many years was the kind of principal proponent Tibetan Buddhism. I mean, principal academic behind Tibetan Buddhism. He argued very forcefully in this debate with Stephen Batchelor that if you don't believe in rebirth, then don't call yourself a Buddhist, and you can't come to enlightenment. So I'm squarely on Stephen Batchelor's side in that argument. Because why? Because in Zen, what are we trying to do? We're trying to be fully aware and alert and responsive in this moment, now, without being having to cleave to any beliefs about the future or the past. In fact, the Buddha himself is supposed to have said, and I always, it's probably prudent whenever we're quoting the Buddha to say his supposedly said, because for the first 200 years of his teaching, it wasn't written down. It was transmitted orally. So who knows what the Buddha actually said, but he himself was once asked by someone, when he was still alive, walking through northern India, someone asked about his past life. And the Buddha said, if you want to know what you were in the past, look at yourself now. If you want to know what you'll be in the future, look at yourself now. And that's pure Zen, you know, even though Zen hadn't really been invented at that point. That's what we're doing. We're looking at ourself now. And that draws us right into Batchelor's second problem, accepting is the doctrine of karma. That statement of the Buddha, if you want to know what you were in the past, look at yourself now. If you want to know what you're in the future, look at yourself now, suggests or implies that there is some element of continuity in who we are, that what we are conditioning now, our karmic obstructions, karmic afflictions, or let's just say our obstructions and our afflictions, our mental, emotional afflictions and challenges and neuroses, that these are in part from the past, through habit force, through things we've thought and said and done for a long time, that creates a kind of momentum, or again, force of habit, that gives us some of these, the architecture of our mind and body that we have to work with now, and that the way we work with it will determine somewhat what we will be like in the future. There's more on karma later, so let's just hold off on going into that further now. He makes a very important point about the development of Buddhism in the West. He said, in contrast to Christianity, which slowly and painfully struggled to come to terms with the consequences of the Renaissance, the European Enlightenment, natural science, democracy, and secularization, Buddhism was catapulted into modernity from deeply conservative agrarian societies in Asia, which were either geographically remote or cut off from the rest of the world through political isolation. I think this is one of his most important contributions, is pointing out that we can't just blindly accept everything from this tradition rooted in ancient Asian culture, because it wouldn't be suitable. not all of it, for sure, maybe not a lot of it. Important, especially for those teaching this or writing about it, that we be aware that the societies, the Asian cultures, which preserved in Buddhism, were deeply conservative, hierarchical, agrarian societies based in agriculture and cut off from the rest of the world. He says that after a lifetime of work in Buddhist studies, the scholar and translator, Edward Kanze, drew the conclusion that Buddhism hasn't had an original idea in 1,000 years. Well, that's our job in the West, is adapting this tradition that was so rooted in societies vastly different from ours, adapting it to our own culture in the meetings, the annual meetings of Zen teachers, North American Zen teachers. This is where we always end up, is agreeing that that's our job as teachers, is to find a way to preserve what is vital, still vital and appropriate about the tradition, to preserve it without clinging to outmoded forms. That's a job that takes decades or centuries. We had a Japanese Roshi here once, way back in the mid to early 70s. And we were talking about some of the struggles we were having with all kinds of things at the center. And he, at one point, said, "Don't worry, the first 200 years are the hardest." He goes on, "When Buddhist communities collided with modernity in the course of the 20th century, they were unprepared for the new kinds of questions and challenges their religion would face in a rapidly changing global and secular world." He continues, "I suspect that a considerable part of the Western enthusiasm for things Buddhist may still be a romantic projection of our yearnings for truth and holiness onto those distant places and peoples about which we know the least." I agree with him there too. I think there's way too much of that in Zen Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism, kind of making, idealizing, as psychologists would say, idealizing people of other cultures, teachers of other cultures. Idealizing is just the flip side of demonizing. What we see most of these days is demonizing Muslims and others, not to mention our president, those who demonize the president, those whom we see as other. I think the term that I've read a few times is very useful, otherism. Well, it cuts both ways. We can also give those of other cultures or races or ethnic groups way too much uncritical worship, is too strong a word, but that's, I think, what happens often in religion. Recently, heard of someone who is long practice in Tibetan Buddhism say flatly that Tibetans are an enlightened culture. What about the three poisons that we all have to struggle with? Greed, anger, and delusion. That is romantic idealization of making that kind of a broad statement about any culture or country or people. Shows such blind naivete. But he runs with this. He says, "I am sometimes alarmed at the uncritical willingness of Westerners to accept at face value whatever is uttered by a Tibetan Lama or Burmese Sayadaw," that's a name for a teacher in Burmese Buddhism, "while they would be generally skeptical were something comparable said by a Christian bishop or Cambridge Don. I do believe that Buddhist philosophy, ethics, and meditation have something to offer in helping us come to terms with many of the personal and social dilemmas of our world." Well, thank you for that, Stephen. "But there are real challenges in translating Buddhist practices, values, and ideas into comprehensive forms of life that are more than just a set of skills acquired in courses on mindfulness-based stress reduction, and that can flourish just as well outside meditation retreat centers as within them. Buddhism might require some radical surgery if it is to get to grips with modernity and find a voice that can speak to the conditions of this saeculum." Again, saeculum meaning this world, this age in which we find ourselves now. This point about the willingness of Westerners to accept at face value whatever is uttered by a Tibetan Lama reminded me of something I've heard more than a couple times, that it's widely taught in Tibetan Buddhist centers that if you doubt the guru, you go to hell. And I think we're becoming, through painful experience of scandals at Buddhist centers, we're growing up in this country. We're coming to find that we can look critically at especially certain conduct of teachers. Way back when Buddhism, Zen was exploding, back in the 60s and 70s, there were just atrocious behavior by certain Japanese teachers that their students would also just blindly acquiesce in and never dare to call them on it. But I think that's changing. Maybe not fast enough, but it's changing. One of the problems is that I was speaking just now in terms of Zen, although this would also apply in Tibetan Buddhism, there is a hierarchy in spiritual matters that I'm absolutely convinced is worth preserving, that if a teacher has been doing this practice for a very long time, then it is suitable to give her or him the benefit of the doubt in matters of practice. In other things, not necessarily. When I succeeded Roshi Kaplow in 1986, or I guess I started in 87, the first thing I did was to remove the abbot, that was him, and then now me, remove the abbot from the board of trustees because the teacher's authority in spiritual matters can too easily be seen as transferable to administrative or, let's say, secular matters. And I'd seen where our trustees with Roshi Kaplow as a member of the trustees had too easily not spoken up. They'd been afraid to speak up when they felt that his judgment about these administrative or financial things was not the best. So there are things we can do to neutralize the kind of blind idealization of the teacher, but I think in the matters of the meditation itself and decisions about teaching, then there is that place for hierarchy, and I will never apologize for it. He goes on, so what sort of Buddhism does a self-declared secular Buddhist like myself advocate? For me, secular Buddhism is not just another modernist reconfiguration of a traditional form of Asian Buddhism. It is neither a reformed Theravada Buddhism like the Vipassana movement. This is interesting how he sees these popular schools. Let me start over. It is neither a reformed Theravada Buddhism, like the Vipassana movement, a reformed Tibetan tradition, like Shambhala Buddhism, a reformed Nichiren school, that's another sect of Buddhism, like the Soka Gakkai. Soka Gakkai is a, last I heard, was quite a militaristic, proselytizing form of so-called Buddhism. Nor is it a reformed Zen lineage like the Order of Interbeing, that's Thich Nhat Hanh, nor a reformed hybrid of some or all of the above. And then he says, like the Triratna Order, this is in England, formerly the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. You can see that how much thought he's given to all this. I really respect his intellect. Stephen Batchelor, he's exceedingly bright with a rigorous mind of scholastic background, history, and extremely thoughtful. He was our guest here at the Zen Center some years ago. We had a symposium, and he was one of the speakers. I really feel a lot of kinship with him, starting with the fact that neither of us ever had any religious upbringing. He goes on, it is more radical than any of these. It seeks to return to the roots of the Buddhist tradition and rethink Buddhism from the ground up. All right, now, what's he mean? He goes on. In exploring such roots, secular Buddhists find themselves excavating two fields that have been opened up in the past century by modern translators and scholars. The first of these two fields consists of the earliest discourses attributed to Siddhartha Gautama, which are primarily found in the Pali canon of the Theravada school. The Pali language is it's kind of a sub-language in India, a sub-language of Sanskrit. And then he says, we're very fortunate as English speakers to have not only a complete translation of the Pali canon, but one that is continually being improved, something that speakers of other European languages can still only dream of. The second of these fields is that of our increasingly detailed, though still disputed and incomplete, understanding of the historical, social, political, religious, and philosophical conditions that prevailed during the Buddha's lifetime in 5th century BCE India. Thanks to scholars, we're beginning to see more clearly the kind of world in which the Buddha taught. Together, these two fields provide a fertile soil for the project of rethinking, perhaps reimagining, the Dharma from the ground up. I find that the word the Dharma is in some ways a better word to use than Buddhism. Buddhism is a word that a Christian missionary came up with when he visited an Asian country and saw the Buddha figures and saw their various practices, and not knowing how to refer to them, came up with the term Buddhism. But the Dharma, I respond to more. It's first, it doesn't have the ism. We're trying to get away from isms in Zen. But also the Dharma really means, and that the Chinese render it as the way, the Tao, the way. It seems a lot less of a fixed kind of belief-based practice. The way is a practice, not a belief system. Or the Dharma, same thing. And then he says, this very wealth of material that's been translated from Pali Canon raises serious difficulties in interpretation. He says it's a complex tapestry of linguistic and rhetorical styles, shot through with conflicting ideas, doctrines, and images, all assembled and elaborated over about four centuries. This is why another reason to respect the Zen tradition, because it's always been known as a teaching beyond words and scriptures, without reliance on words and concepts. We don't need to believe in texts. We don't need to be overly concerned with translations, because we're trying to get beyond words to the spirit behind them, the inner experience, the direct experience of the present. How insecure we would be if we based our faith on words, on even the most respected religious texts. The canon, he says, does not speak with a single voice. How then to distinguish between what is likely to have been the word of the Buddha as opposed to a well-intended clarification, that's in quotation marks, added by a later commentator? Yeah, this is the other thing, is the not just commentators, the scribes, the those who copied these manuscripts for centuries and thought that they knew better, or they changed something, and then it went on and became changed and mutated in other ways. It's like that game of telephone where you whisper something to someone, and then they whisper it to someone else, and then by the time it gets to the eighth person, it's completely mangled. He says, we are not yet and may never be at a point where such questions can be answered with certainty. Be that as it may, as a Buddhist practitioner, I looked at the Buddha's discourses not just for scholarly knowledge, but in order to help me come to terms with what the Chinese call the great matter of birth and death. It is in this sense that my secular Buddhism still has a religious quality to it, because it is the conscious expression of my, quote, ultimate concern, as the theologian Paul Tillich once defined faith. Our ultimate concern. Great is the matter of birth and death. He says, as one who feels an urgency about such concerns, I am bound, therefore, to risk choices of interpretation now that may or may not turn out to be viable later. My starting point is to bracket anything attributed to the Buddha in the canon that could just as well have been said by a Brahmin priest or Jain monk. These were other Hinduism and Jainism were preceded Buddhism in India of the same period. So when the Buddha says that a certain action will produce a good or bad result in a future heaven or hell, or when he speaks of bringing to an end the repetitive cycle of rebirth and death in order to attain nirvana, I take such utterances to be determined by the common metaphysical outlook of that time, rather than reflecting an intrinsic component of the Dharma. I thus give central importance to those teachings in the Buddha's Dharma that cannot be derived from the Indian worldview of the 5th century BCE, before Christ.
John, can you give me a clock?
Yeah. And here, I think we can just raise the question of how valid that is, giving central importance to that which cannot be derived from the Indian worldview. I know he's not saying that fifth century before the Christian era worldview is all wrong, but I would suggest that there may be a great deal of profound wisdom in that original worldview of ancient India, and that we don't need to, because it was preceded the Buddha, we don't need to dismiss it. There's any tradition that's lasted for thousands of years or many hundreds of years, there has to be wisdom somewhere in there. It may not be very obvious with certain rituals and forms that have sprung up, but I would be more inclined to I would not be so quick to kind of bracket those things. When I said some of the things from ancient religious traditions strike us as it was hard to swallow, I'm thinking of this story about how if we're not, we have to be watchful that our rituals that we adopt, they may not make sense in a rational sense, but there's a place for discerning what is appropriate. So with regard to doing prostrations, this was a big stumbling block for me when I first began sitting with the Ann Arbor Zen group. And when I was just out of college, where I just I didn't particularly want to do prostrations, which are just part of our tradition, the Zen and Buddhist tradition, and there you could say it doesn't make sense, it doesn't make rational sense to be doing that, to do a prostration before the Buddha figure on an altar. But yet there is, when you do it, when you get used to doing it, if you can overcome your resistance and your pride, that's often behind it, if you can overcome your pride and sort of trust that anything that's lasted for many hundreds of years, like that, doing prostrations, may have some wisdom behind it. If you can then do it, even begrudgingly, if you can do it, then you can start to understand in your body that there is wisdom behind it. Now, in contrast to that, are some things that you can, in any religion, rituals that may have snuck in out of blind acquiescence. And here's that, back to that story. Told by Jack Kornfield and Christina Feldman, there was once a guru who sat down to worship every evening only to be disturbed by the cat who lived at the ashram. This is not Buddhism, but it's all right, same thing. Disturbed by the cat who lived at the ashram, so he ordered that the cat be tied up during the evening worship. After the guru died, the cat continued to be tied up during the evening worship. And when that cat died, another cat was brought to the ashram so that it could be duly tied up during the evening worship. Centuries later, learned treatises were written by the guru's scholarly disciples on the liturgical significance of tying up a cat while worship is performed. That's the kind of thing we have to be alert to. There's an author of a book called Secret Tibet who makes this point. Formality is abominable when it is an empty shell, but where there is real feeling behind it, that feeling can be made more significant by being enclosed in a formal pattern. So like prostrations or bowing or chanting. Just as movement can be made more significant when turned into dance, or sound when turned into music. It does take a measure of humility when stepping into a long tradition to accept that some things we may not understand are worth doing. And that, admittedly, that is what sometimes separates those who stick with this practice and those who go elsewhere. It's just that ability to subordinate one's own ideas, notions, to the tradition. Some time ago, I realized that what I found most difficult to accept in Buddhism were those beliefs that it shared with its sister Indian religions, Hinduism and Jainism. Yet when you bracket those beliefs, you are left not with a fragmentary and an emasculated teaching, but with an entirely adequate ethical, philosophical, and practical framework for living your life in this world. Thus, what is truly original in the Buddha's teaching, I discovered, was his secular outlook. When you bracket the quasi-divine attributes that the figure of the Buddha is believed to possess, and this he's referring to in the old texts, you read the 32 marks, the physical marks of a Buddha, which I always thought was ridiculous. For example, a fleshy head protuberance, golden skin, and so forth. If you bracket those, he says, and focus on the episodes in the canon that recount his often fraught dealings with his contemporaries, then the humanity of Siddhartha Gautama begins to emerge with more clarity. All this supports what the British scholar Trevor Ling surmised nearly 50 years ago, that what we now know as Buddhism started life as an embryonic civilization or culture that then mutated into another organized Indian religion. Secular Buddhism, which seeks to articulate a way of practicing the Dharma in this world and time, thus finds vindication through its critical return to canonical sources and its attempts to recover a vision of Gautama's own saeculum. Always, in anything we read of any writer on the Dharma, or teacher, we can't ignore what the teacher's own conditioning is. This goes back to the word karma, is that we are all bound to some degree by our conditioning. And And we know from Batchelor's own words that he was raised in a very secular, not just a secular environment, but a very intellectual background. So this would be his tendency, for better and for worse, is to see things with that perspective, through the prism of the reason and logic. He's enormously reasoned, logical guy, which is refreshing in a sense when there's so many, especially in Tibetan Buddhism, who are so attached to uncritical acceptance of Tibetan superstition. But you can go too far the other way too, in terms of relying on the reason, our rational mind. In Zen, Zen practice is aimed at helping us transcend the limitations of our logical, rational mind, because it's such a small part of the mind. George Bernard Shaw said, "The one who listens to reason is lost. Reason enslaves all whose minds are not strong enough to master it." You find through long practice that there is unfathomable depths to the mind that cannot be understood with the intellect. Francis Bacon, "A little philosophy inclineth men's minds to atheism, but depth in philosophy bringeth men's minds about to religion." And then, just skipping a paragraph here, he mentions awakening. "Awakening is not a mystical insight into the true nature of mind or reality, but rather the opening up of a way of being in this world that is no longer determined by one's greed, hatred, fear, and selfishness." Now here, I think I have to take issue with this. I have to say, I cannot leave this out of this Taisho, I have to say that I don't see Stephen Batchelor as having awakened to his true nature. So when he says, "Awakening is not a mystical insight into the true nature of mind or reality," well, it is, Stephen. It is, but his point still is well taken. And it's an opening up of a way of being in this world that is no longer determined by one's greed. Blah, blah, blah. "Thus, awakening is not a state, but a process, an ethical way of life and commitment that enables human flourishing." This is a little squishy about how just every day we have an awakening. I think he's reducing the term awakening from what the Buddha and all the masters have said, which is that it is an actual experience that changes your whole perspective on reality and on yourself and others. It is a turning about in the mind in which you see everything as the same and yet different. He's minimizing what a true awakening is, and yet at the same time, I salute him for making the point that we can't ever rest on an experience. Just because we have an experience of awakening doesn't place us in some special category, but rather it is our obligation, our responsibility of having awakened, is that we live up to that in our life, that we show through our conduct, in our responsiveness to others, that awakened nature. So it's rather than speaking about a person who's enlightened, an enlightened person, we really ought to be understand it as what is enlightened activity. Because you can have someone who's had an experience of awakening, but then who doesn't live up to that and behaves badly. And you can also have someone who hasn't yet had the experience, but who upholds the precepts and upholds our true nature. Very important point. I had a couple of other points I wanted to get to, but our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.